This is a Federal News Network podcast.
Do you know a federal employee facing a tragedy like their own or a family member's serious illness or death in the family? Is the tragedy also causing financial struggles? Feds Helping Feds charity, FIA, might be able to help. FIA offers no-fee, no-interest loans to feds experiencing a variety of hardships. Special thanks to Blue Cross Blue Shield and Care First Blue Cross Blue Shield for supporting FIA in expanding this program. Find eligibility requirements and other program details at fia.org/emergency.
Welcome to Your Turn with Mike Causey, brought to you by WEPA on Federal News Network. WEPA is the life insurance choice of over 46,000 federal workers and their families. Learn more at WAEPA.org. Here's your host, Mike Causey.
Hey, welcome to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, and we're delighted to have you with us today. My guest is Arthur Stein. He's a very well-known financial planner in the Washington area. Many, if not most, of his clients are either active or retired feds, and he's got several TSP millionaires among his flock. And our timing actually could not have been better than today, because beginning in June, the Federal Thrift Savings Plan is going to be offering roughly 5,000 new choices. That's 50000. 5,000 new choices that's going to be added to the 12 to 15 that feds now have to invest in. And it's an exciting time. It's a scary time, because if you've been reading the news and watching the news, you know that things are not going well in many areas. And these are very tough economic times. And in addition to deciding what to do with their thrift savings plan accounts during these difficult times, coronavirus, war in Europe, threats in the Middle East, monkeypox, you name it, we're having it. In addition to that, people will very soon, or in June of 2022, will have 5,000 new options to deal with. So Art to the rescue. Art, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Hey, have you sort of got any thoughts? Because I know your theme, as always, is when you're investing, is go long. Look at the big picture, the long picture, and we've discussed the use of the word safe as far as the G fund, the Treasury Securities Fund, is concerned. But let's start out with this new offering that the Thrift Savings Plan is going to make, and it will be allowing its current investors to invest a chunk of their portfolio into any or, in theory, all of the 5,000 new plans are being offered. This is a tremendous challenge for people, isn't it? The timing of both these?
Yeah, it's absolutely one. It's a huge change in the TSP. I mean, I'd say it's the biggest change in the TSP since the introduction of the ELF funds. And but it comes with its own set of difficulties and costs and expenses and things like that. One of the things I would point out is, as you say, there are going to be more than 5,000 funds available to invest in. Now, the amount that people can put in the what's called the mutual fund window, which is where these funds are going to, let's say, exist or be available, is limited. The minimum initial transfer is $10,000, and the maximum that someone can have invested in this mutual fund window can never exceed 25% of their total TSP balance. Now, so you would need, just to get the $10,000, you would need to have at least $40,000 in the TSP before you could do a $10,000 transfer. I don't think that's really important to most of the people considering this. But if someone has $1 million in the TSP, they can't transfer more than $250,000 into this mutual fund window. It's not going to be a cheap place to invest. There's an annual account maintenance fee of $95, and then there's going to be an annual fee of $55 to compensate the TSP for expenses. And of course, each of the mutual funds is going to have some kind of expense ratio. We don't know if it's going to be high or low. And every trade that is made, they're going to charge a $28.75 fee. So not cheap.
Yeah.
But the other thing I'm struck by is, you know, 5,000 choices. I mean, Mike, yeah, I've known you for I don't know, more than 20 years.
Yeah.
We have spent so much time discussing which of the five traditional funds to invest in, and then which of the, once they added the L funds, which of the five or 10 L funds would make the most sense and whether the L fund makes the most sense. Now we're going to be talking about 5,015 funds. We'll have to do this show 24/7 for the rest of our lives.
We will need to set up a hotline for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And I so far have not seen that the TSP is going to offer any way to analyze these funds, compare the funds, look at the different expense ratios and rates of return. Our estimate in our office is that 5,000 funds, if they're all mutual funds, that would be approximately half the mutual funds in the United States.
Wow.
Not counting the different share classes. So there are going to be, you know, all kinds of different funds with different investment objectives. Of course, one that I know a certain number of people are looking for are what are called ESG funds. These are things that are good about looking at companies' impact on the environment and society at large and their governance and how they treat their employees. So that's a nice addition. But, you know, in the past, we've spoken about, well, should they have a real estate fund? And they don't, of course, but I would think that of the 5,000 will be some REITs. They're called real estate investment trusts. I consider that to be a good change. But then I don't know, you know, some of the other ones I think that I'm not going to like as much.
Well, you know, it's interesting, but for ever since the thrift savings plan started, there's been political pressure, financial pressure, and social pressure on the board to open up more funds, and people want to get their cause in. Some people just want to get a piece of the action, but and they resisted it through thick and thin pressure from both Democrats and Republicans. Now this is actually happening. As you point out, this may be half of the mutual funds in the country. If at 5,000, and this would be a difficult choice for people, a good one for some, I'm sure, but a difficult choice for people at the best of times if we were at the top of the market, but we're not. You know, we don't know how much further this is going to go down. Are we in for a recession? Are we overdue? Are we already in a bear market? But this is a very emotional time for people to be looking at their investments, isn't it?
Yeah, and I would say that this is an interesting time for anybody who thinks that they can do market timing,
yeah,
which is moving money in and out of the stock funds, presumably taking money out of the stock funds before you get a big market decline and putting it back in before the market starts to go back up. So someone who thinks they are good at market timing, you know, might be someone who at the end of last year, or early this year, took all their money out of the stock funds, mm-hmm, and avoided year-to-date decreases of 14% to 24%.
Yeah. Excuse me. Eric White, our producer, wants us to take a break here, and I'm okay. Overdue. But we'll be right back here on federalnewsnetwork.com, 1500 AM.
As you navigate the uncertainties of our new reality, Federal News Network is here to guide you through it. Download our revamped mobile app for all the latest news and information on your agency's evolving telework, pay and leave policies, acquisition guidance, and what this all means for your TSP. We are here to serve you. the dedicated federal employees and contractors who continue to serve your mission. The Federal News Network app, available on the App Store and on Google Play.
Hey, welcome to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, talking with Arthur Stein. He is a very well-known Washington-area financial planner. Most of his customers, clients, are active or retired federal workers, and some have been extremely successful following his advice. Before the break, we were talking about this new venture of the Thrift Savings Plan. In June 2022, investors will be able to choose not only from the 5 to 15 currently available funds, but there are going to be another 5,000, 5,000. And Art said by his reckoning that maybe represents about half of the entire mutual fund market, and that includes things like real estate REITs, real estate trust funds, social funds, of governance funds, and the decisions are mind-boggling for people who are considering it, and especially coming at a time like this. And Art, before the break, you were talking about market timing, and I think most people know what it is. You buy low and sell high, and it's a great idea, and if you do it right, it works handsomely for you. Most people don't and can't do it right, correct?
Yeah. And what I was saying, the problem with market timing is you have to make two good decisions. Yeah. One, when to get out of the stock funds, and two, when to get back in the stock funds. So, you know, if someone got out at the end of last year, I'm sure they're congratulating themselves on getting out before a big decline. But now, I mean, year to date, the S&P is down, the C fund, which is an S&P 500 index fund, is down 18%. The F fund, a bond fund, is down 9%. S fund's down 24%. I fund's down 14%. So now the question is, well, Mr. or Mrs. or Miss Market Timer, are you getting back in now? Are you waiting? And if you wait, don't you run the risk of, you know, the market all of a sudden taking a big upward step and you've missed out? And that's what makes market timing so difficult. And of course, nobody feels like getting back in the market when it's doing really bad, because it's doing bad usually for reasons that we know that seem pretty catastrophic. The Fed raising interest rates, of course, is not catastrophic. It's bad for the stock market. It's supposed to slow down the economy. We may go into a recession as a result. But what's going on in Russia, you know, that's potentially catastrophic if, you know, they start using nuclear weapons. And there's some other geopolitical risks. Of course, we always have the COVID risk. Maybe we get a new variant that's a lot more deadly than what's been going around. So it's pretty scary out there, and it always is during a big market decline. But market timers need to get back in before things get better, because stocks are considered to be a leading economic indicator. They tend to go down before the economy declines and, you know, potentially goes into a recession. And they tend to go up before the economy starts recovering or while it's still in a recession. So it makes market timing very difficult, because you can't rely on the economy to give you the signal about when to buy and sell.
Well, I've talked with and heard about people who, during the Great Recession of 2008, 2009, pulled out of the market. They were lucky or wise or something, but they got out of the market when the stocks were high, put them into the G fund, the Treasury Securities Fund, and parked them, and then they continued to buy the G fund only. So they thought they were being safe, and they were in one sense. On the other hand, they missed this huge market surge, a record-long bull market, and they missed all of that. They missed buying stocks when they went on sale, and some, as you point out, have still not come back to the market. So they made one good move, but not the other.
Yeah, and as a result, it was you know, disastrous for them in terms of the amount of money that they have now, because they missed out on all those great years of all those many increases since the market bottomed in 2008-09. And of course, many of the people did get out, only got out after the stock market.
Even worse.
So this is a great time to think about your market timing skills, because hey, it's down. What you were, now it could go down a lot more. The C funds down 18%. You know, a 36% decline in the C fund would not be huge. Mm-hmm. It would not be historically the longest by a long shot. That's more like 45%. And same thing with the other funds. And so as a result, you know, you have to decide what to do. And I think it's very difficult for people to do.
Well, that's it. It's a major financial decision and a long-term financial decision, and you're making it almost 100% on emotion because there's nothing else to go at. If I could plug today's column, today's Federal Report, because R. Stein wrote most of it, and in it he gives his theory or his reasons for saying that people should take the long view of these things. And in it you included one of your always excellent charts, and it's so interesting here because it shows – the five major funds, G, F, C, S, and I, and there's the year-to-date, which is pretty miserable except for the G fund. One-year returns, 3, 5, 10, 15. And when you look at the long run, which is what you're advising people to do, over a 10-year period, the C fund was up almost 14%. Over a 5-year period, it was up 12. 3-year, up 13. And the others follow suit. So there
is, and remember, Mike, that's the annual average return.
Right, right.
So, for instance, the C fund over the last 10 years, and this is through May 20th, which is last Friday, averaged 14% a year, which is a huge return. It meant it was doubling in value about every 5.5 years.
Yeah. And that doesn't happen if you've pulled out in 2008 and kept your money in the G fund.
Yeah, I mean, historically, if you didn't sell, if you just stayed in the stock funds, I mean, the I fund is not, you know, it's a whole separate story,
right,
but the C and the S fund. If you just stayed in them, and especially if you continued investing, if you were an employee and your bi-weekly contributions were going in, historically, you would have had a really excellent rate of return and done very well. You just would have to ignore big market dips.
Well, I'm sort of the poster boy for that, which is exactly what I did during the recession. You know, we took pay cuts, and, you know, things were looking dire. People were worried about downsizing and all that. And I continued buying as I had been, you know, biweekly in our 401k plan, our TSP, and every quarter when I'd get a statement, it was down, even including the money that I put into it. It was still down. I did nothing. And lo and behold, sometime in March of 2009 or thereabouts, when things started pulling back, the money had almost doubled. I had continued to buy stocks, and it turns out they were on sale. I don't pretend to know, say that I knew what was happening, but at least I didn't do the wrong thing.
Yeah, and you know, really, one of the things that we're speaking about here is asset allocation, and what that means is what percentage of your investments in the TSP, and of course your other investments too.
Yeah.
Do you want to have in stocks and bonds? And that leads to another issue, which when you think about the TSP funds, don't think about, do I want to be in the CFGI fund? Think about, do I want to invest in stocks, or do I want to invest in bonds, or have a certain percentage in stocks and bonds? And what types of stocks and bonds do I want to invest in? And then choose those funds, because when you put money in the C fund, that goes into the S&P 500 index. There are 500 companies that are in that index, and that money you put in the C fund is used to buy shares of those companies. It's a stock investment. When you put money in the F fund, it's a bond investment. They're the TSP, the people who manage the funds for the TSP, take that money and use it to buy what are called intermediate term bonds, U.S. bonds. About 40% of them are government bonds, and the remainder are corporate and a couple other different types of bonds. So that's a bond investment. G funds, a bond investment. So if you had 50% of your money in the C fund, say 25% G and 25% in F, then you've invested 50% of your money in stocks and 50% of your money in bonds. And your bond investment, half of it is in intermediate term bonds, half of it's in short-term U.S. government bonds. That's asset allocation. And everybody needs to think about and manage the asset allocation of their investments.
And you have suggested, too, in the column that there you should be in different investments depending on how close you are in age at retirement to using those funds. In other words,
well, that to me is really kind of a misunderstood concept because, you know, all the academic studies are that really the allocation to stocks needs to continue during long retirements, and not just any allocation to stocks, but really more than 50% stocks is what someone would need to invest if they want to maximize their chances of not outliving their investments, not exhausting their investments before they die.
Hey, on that subject, Art, let us take a break here because I wanted to ask you some very specifics about that. But we need to take a break here on federalnewsnetwork.com, 1500 AM. Be right back.
Federal News Network, helping feds meet their mission.
Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. Glad to have you with us, as always. And we have a second half of the show that's going to be of interest to people, whether you're a federal worker or retiree, and especially if you are a participant in the Thrift Savings Plan. My guest is Drew Friedman. She is a relatively new staffer at Federal News Network, but I'm amazed at how quickly she's caught onto the beat. It's a little bit scary, but Drew, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Mike.
Hey, we're going to divide it up today because you have kind of the sexy beat, pay and benefits, and a lot of work, a lot of stuff going on, but it's also of a lot of interest. And look, go with the pay raise first, the status of it. And if I could interject here, federal pay raise and federal cost of living adjustment are two different critters. The pay raise is really it's a decision made by Congress and the White House, and it's based on fiscal concerns, money, politics, as always. Midterm elections are different times because of the pressures on members of Congress. And, of course, now we have runaway inflation. So with that, where is the pay portion of this standing now?
So we saw from President Joe Biden back in March request a pay raise of 4.6% across the board for federal employees in fiscal 2023. And since then, more recently, we've seen the House Appropriations Committee effectively endorse that 4.6% proposal, which gives it a little bit of a leg up. So it's moving forward a bit. The Financial Services and General Government bill from the House Appropriations Committee made no mention of the pay raise, which essentially means that they are aligning with Biden's suggestion. And that has been common in the past few years to default to the White House's proposal. But as I said, that pay raise is across the board, so it doesn't account yet for locality pay adjustments. That's something that we might see later on. And the bill is now moving to full consideration for the full House.
Right, and I guess there's always a possibility of more because you have some members of the House, some Democrats, are pushing. Is it 5.1%?
That's right. So they're pushing an additional 0.5% above the president's request, so 5.1%. And we also saw that's through legislation called the FAIR Act. And they're saying that, you know, because of rising inflation rates and things like that, that they want a little bit more money for federal employees. That we haven't seen anything really advance with that bill yet. So the 4.6% seems more likely at this point, but it's hard to say exactly.
Right. And as you said, we don't know what the locality pay amount will be, if any. Recently, it's been like a half a percentage point, and that does make a difference. But, you know, people in Manhattan make more than people in Manhattan, Kansas, that sort of thing. And the amount, it would seem to many people, 4.651 doesn't really matter, but it does, because the miracle of compounding, you know, the more money you get and then you pile more onto that. And federal workers in the last few years, there have been times when the military got a larger percentage increase, and some people were resentful of that.
Right. And so we'll see exactly how that plays out. We've also seen we have not yet seen the Senate Appropriations Committee, their draft spending bill, which is the partnership legislation for that House bill that I mentioned. So it's a little bit up in the air. But yes, as you said, there is a difference. And it's hard to say exactly what that will look like. But,
right.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the Appropriations Committee went along with the White House recommendation. But anything else in the appropriations bill for feds?
There actually was a lot in that financial services and general government bill that is notable for feds. So if you look at the Office of Personnel Management, for example, that the bill's spending includes an increase of $70.9 million over the enacted level for 2022. And that would in part go to funding retirement services and the modernization of that system for federal employees. So they're asking in the bill, they mentioned heightened oversight and transparency in OPM's retirement services. And we've also seen Kiran Ahuja, who's the director of OPM, recently talking about piloting an online application system for retirement services. So that's something that is kind of in the works, and we'll see how that kind of plays out in the larger or in the full Senate. And we also saw a provision in the Federal Employee Health Benefit Program that in this bill from the House Oversight or from the House Committee that would remove a ban that stops the plan from covering abortions. So that's something that was included in the bill last year as well. It was ultimately removed, but the House Democrats are pushing for that again this year.
So now, I'm sorry, how does that work again? The bill, the pending bill would ban abortions?
The pending bill would remove, there's currently a
ban on them.
Currently in the Federal Employee Health Benefit Program, you cannot get, it doesn't cover the cost of abortions, but this would remove that, so federal employees could get abortions under that health plan.
Oh, okay. So that could be a major fight,
yeah.
Obviously.
And it was something that they were pushing for last year. It did not get included, so they're pushing for it again. So we'll see how that plays out in the full Senate or in the full House. It's up in the air, though.
Yeah, I would think it was a big deal then, but now with the repealing Roe v. Wade, it's
right.
Twice as big a deal. Maybe throwing you a curve here, if I do apologize, but the Postal Service is splitting off their health program from the regular federal employee program. And I've read, our colleague Jory Heckman's been writing about it, and that which is all I know about it, but they've been saying that both the split, it should lower premiums for both groups, both white-collar feds and postal employees. And I just don't see how that, I don't doubt it, but I don't understand it.
Yeah, that's something that it seems like, you know, as Jory's been covering, that is not for sure yet, but we can't really say for sure what that will.
Yeah, because the Postal Service has pre-funding and all that sort of thing, but I just thought that was a very, it's almost like a political claim, you know, we'll say this to get it through, get it done, but there's not based in fact.
Right.
Anyhow, we'll get on to that. COLAs, cost of living adjustments for federal retirees, military retirees, and they prefer to, they talk about they get retired military pay. And, of course, people under Social Security, one in every six Americans. Huge deal every January. And a COLA, unlike the pay raise, a COLA is strictly following the inflation as measured by the government. The Labor Department uses the CPI, W, Consumer Price Index, W. Drive you mad looking at it. Every now and then we'll publish charts. But the bottom line is it's the increase in living costs using this government yardstick from the third quarter of the current year over the third quarter of last year. So where are we now in that cost of living countdown?
It's It's still unsure. We have a couple more months before we're going to see the actual announcement for it. That index, the consumer price index that you mentioned, it has gone up 9.3% over the last 12 months. So that is a huge jump. That's compared with an average inflation rate of about 8.6% right now. And we also saw for that same price index that in just the month of May, it went up 1.2%. So that's something that's growing over time. If you look back even just a few months ago in April, they were predicting that the COLA would be maybe around 7% for 2023. And even that number is now higher. So the inflation keeps growing. The index keeps growing. So it's hard to say exactly for sure. But, we'll have to wait till the numbers are finalized through the end of this September, and then the official COLA will be announced in October.
Yeah, that's what's really struck people is we've had relatively low inflation for decades now. This is, I think, the news headlines are highest in 40 years, and it's a combination of things, but it's something people are so unaccustomed to. And back when they were predicting a 6 or 7% COLA, people were, wide-eyed, and now it's pushing 10, isn't it?
Exactly. So as I said, it's at 9.3% right now. So it could go up even more. I mean, gas prices are still climbing, and there's other factors in inflation that could push that number up even further. So we'll just have to wait and see. But we did see, last year for the 2022 COLA, it was at 5.9%, which
was high. Yeah.
That was huge, and that was the largest in 40 years. That's compared with the past a decade, it's usually about a 1, 2, or 3% raise. So that is a huge jump there, and it could be an even bigger jump for next year.
Right, and a big factor, too, I think sometimes many people overlook, everybody thinks bigger is better. Well, yes and no, because with the way it's you could explain it, but people who are under the FERS retirement system, which is most workers, get a diet COLA, a diet cost of living adjustment. So if it's 2%, they both get FERS and CERS, the civil service retirement, they each get the same amount. But if it's over 3, they get a 1 percentage point reduction. And over years of inflation, that's a problem.
That's right. And, we saw in 2022, for example, I said that the COLA rate was at 5.9%, but those under FERS would have gotten 4.9%, so 1% lower. So we could see that adjustment continuing. It seems likely at this point that it will be much more than 3% for next year. So it seems like they will likely get the 1% less than that full amount. But there is, I saw recently that in May there was some House legislation from Virginia Democrat Jerry Connolly that would give equal or full COLA to FERS retirees. And that, that hasn't made a lot of progress yet. It's been referred to the Oversight and Reform Committee in the House. So there is some push on Capitol Hill to try to even that out between FERS and CERS retirees. But for now, it is likely that they'll get the 1% less.
And that's why politicians like it when people don't have long memories, because when they decided to split the systems and set up the FERS program, it was set up for people who do not make government a career, which is the majority of government workers. It's like 60% don't retire from the government. So for them, FERS is a better, more portable system. Social Security and a more generous FERS thrift savings plan contribution. So they said, give us this and we'll be happy. Now they're backtracking 30 years and they're saying we want to make them equal. And if that happened, and I'm guessing now, but you've been up on the Hill, if that happened, and I don't think it will, if the FERS employees got a full COLA, then if I were in the CSRS system, I would demand that we get the same 5% contribution to our thrift savings plan.
Right. Yeah. It's hard to say exactly, what FERS and CERS retirees, what that will look like in the future. But for now, it is going to be this slight decrease for those who retire under the FERS system.
Yeah. Well, we still got a pandemic, maybe a new one coming. We have supply chain problems that may not be fixed for 4 or 5, maybe more years. We have a land war in Europe going, and Eric White, our producer, has just given us a signal to take a break, so that's even more important. We'll do that, and we'll be right back here on federalnewsnetwork.com, 1500 AM. Hey, Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with Drew Friedman. She covers the pay and benefits beat, which is for us is extremely important, as you can imagine. First half of the of her segment, we covered the federal pay raise and the COLA. And if you missed that, obviously we're going to be archived on our homepage, so you can come back at any time. Drew, the big one, the big deal, the Thrift Savings Plan conversion, the one that's had everybody in town jumping about. Some background on this. This is the biggest, it's the biggest everything, the biggest 401k in the country, correct?
That's right. So it covers, you know, millions of federal employees are enrolled in the TSP system. And this update, which they launched on June 1st, which the board that manages the TSP system, the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board, they basically overturned their record keeper on June 1st, which means that they're transferring, you know, millions of points of data. So all of TSP participants, financial history, account information, personal information, things like that. So it was a very, you know, labor-intensive process trying to move all of that over. And there have been, like you said, a lot of bumps in the road in rolling that out. We're about a month in now. But there are still problems continuing with this, the rollout of this.
Well, you know, the enormity of this thing, I think in a story you did recently, there's something like 6.6 million participants. These are people who are no longer in government, people who are retired from government, people who are currently in government, and the military, which we often forget to say. But this is a huge group of people, very intelligent, very savvy with it, and to take this system and change it. I mean, to me, it's one of those, what could possibly go wrong? I would think there would be more problems than there are.
Right. So there have been problems. So some of the main problems have been issues with people trying to log into their accounts, customer service delays as a result of that. So people who are having difficulties navigating the new My Account system. But, you know, the board says that they're trying to work through that. So, for example, they are adding more customer service representatives to try to deal with the influx of calls. But they also said that the reason for moving it over is basically just to put all of the all of that record keeping system under one vendor and one system that can be more secure, you know, prevent more fraud in the system and just help participants secure their money and their investments for retirement.
Because the TSP was hacked some years ago, I believe. And they were very worried about that. So security is a top line thing.
Right. They are trying to make it more secure. And they have said that their top priority is securing investments from everyone who is a TSP participant. But that being said, they have seen some issues with the rollout and some common complaints from TSP participants. For example, we've seen, you know, people say that they can't designate a beneficiary correctly in the system, or that they can't see their financial history further back than 10 years. So there are some concerns about the way the new system is set up. A lot of people have also said that they just simply don't like the way the new interface looks, or they can't find certain tools like an annuity calculator that were easily available in the last system. So, you know, some people are saying that they just don't like it. Don't like the new system, but overall, the board has said that 95% of people who have attempted to log into the new My Account have been successful. So it seems like some of the early technical issues are going away. However, they still have a lot of customer service issues, people trying to call Thriftline, not getting through, or waiting hours on hold. And so the problems do continue, and the board is trying to work through some of that.
Well, you know, without sounding like an apologist for the board, because I had don't even know that much about it. I'm not involved other than covering it. But I saw something the other day that last year, I believe, the Internal Revenue Service only answered one of 10, every 10 calls, you know, 10% of 100 calls, which tells you something, and this is the way it is. And I know my credit union, when I call them, I'm frequently put on hold or given a number and told to call back. So this is with the TSP, you just can't emphasize how big it is.
That's right. It is huge. And if you're looking at the size of their customer service staff, they actually increased it by 66% over the last month. So that's a huge jump. So now the staff is at 800 employees. They're planning to add another 100 over the course of the next week. So it's something where they're trying to, you know, fix the issue, trying to bring down the wait times. They said they've seen a slight decline in call hold times, but it's still they said they're nowhere where they need to be for the staff members. So they're trying to continue that. It's, you know, something that a lot of participants have reached out and to say that, you know, they are frustrated with the customer service, those who do try to reach out.
Well, and I think sometimes, too, people forget, particularly if you're involved in something, but this is not only for your letter carrier and for your forest ranger and for your typical employee at the Pentagon, but this also covers senators, House staff members, members of the cabinet, and some of the biggest thrift savings plan accounts have been money transferred in by either members of Congress or political appointees who brought a huge nest egg with them and they bring it in, but they have a vested interest in this. They want it to work. They want it to run properly. They want it to be accurate and fast and cheap. And so there's an awful lot of oversight on this.
That's right. There, you know, this covers, as you said, 6.6 million participants. And we actually have seen also some concerns from Capitol Hill about the TSP system and the rollout of it. So DC Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton actually wrote to the TSP board to basically demand solutions or explanations for all the issues that they're seeing. So it is something that's touching a lot of different places.
Oh, excuse me, I want to step on you because Eric's given us about a minute here.
Sure.
But I wanted to ask you about the 5,000 new funds. 5,000 new funds. How's that going?
So we've seen, the board said that they've seen about 1,200 or so. That was the most recent number I have for people who have enrolled in a mutual fund window. But only 879 of those accounts have actually put money down for the mutual funds. So that's something that it seems like out of, you know, millions of participants.
6.6 million, yeah.
Right. So it is something that seems to have a slow takeoff there. When we talked about or when we asked our asked survey respondents about it, a lot said that the costs associated with it might be a bit of a turnoff.
And could you tell us the costs? I know there's three basic costs that don't apply to people who don't invest in the 5,000 funds, but for those who do, the fees are...
Yes, so it's completely optional. It's $55 annual fee, $95 annual maintenance fee, and $28.75 per trade fee. You also have to put down an initial investment of $10,000.
All right. Drew Friedman, thank you so much for being a guest today. Good beat, and you're doing a good job covering it. Thank you, Eric, for
thank
pushing
you, Mike.
The buttons and making it work. And we'll see you all, we hope, here next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Stay safe.
You've been listening to Your Turn with Mike Causey, brought to you by WEPA on Federal News Network. WEPA is the life insurance choice of over 46,000 federal workers and their families. Learn more at weepa.org.
I'm WEPA CEO Shane Canfield, and thank you for joining us on another episode of Lessons in Leadership. I'm honored to be joined by Angie Bailey, founder and CEO of Ananda Life. Angie has a remarkable career in public service, beginning as a GS-2 clerk typist with the Social Security Administration. And over the next 40 years, Angie steadily worked her way up through the government, ultimately becoming the Chief Human Capital Officer at the Department of Homeland Security. She's been recognized with presidential rank awards by two administrations for leadership, innovation, dedication, and commitment to the country. Angie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Shane. What a pleasure to be here.
Angie, you've made quite a name for yourself as a leader in the federal workforce. Who was the first person you remember looking up to as a leader, and what about them inspired you?
You know, I often think about this because, you know, sometimes we think of the people that we look up to the most as being somebody that throughout our career has, you know, been at the highest levels and all. But, I've got to go back to honestly whenever I was 10 years old. And I remember I really wanted to play Little League baseball on a boys team. I was the only girl. And interestingly, it was the women who would keep saying to me that, no, I couldn't play. And then one day, whenever I was there to sign up yet again, there was this guy, his name was Delbert Beiser. And I remember he had like red hair and he had a wad of tobacco in his mouth and greasy overalls and everything. And he said, you know, I'll take her on my team. And, you know, just looking back on that, there's so many leadership lessons and things that I just really admire about him. And actually, I thought about throughout my entire career. He took a chance on somebody he didn't know. He put aside whatever conscious or unconscious biases that he might have had about having a girl on a team. He treated me the same. Whether, you know, if I wasn't performing, I got benched just like the boys. I got no special treatment. And he was just really honest with me. And he just included me in everything. And so looking back on it, you know, really, it was Delbert Beiser, our local mechanic in our little small village, that was, I think, my inspiration for going on to, I hope, become the leader, you know, that I wanted to be.
I'd say half of the guests on this podcast have had similar stories where they reach back to either childhood or young adulthood. And I think as leaders, it's really incumbent upon us to keep that in mind, that what we say and do, especially in the younger ages, really can have a lifelong impact. How would you describe your leadership style and how's that developed over time?
I would say that the one word that describes my leadership style is that I care. I guess that's more than one word, but I care. I've always cared about the mission. I've always cared about the people. I've always cared, you know, about making sure that they had what they needed or that they were developing the way, you know, that they aspired to develop. And I tried to take this approach of not treating people the way I wanted to be treated, but instead treat people the way they want to be treated. And I think that really kind of developed over my career. You know, I started out just like most leaders do, where it's very results driven. It's all about the bottom line. You need to make sure that you get everything accomplished because, you know, that's what everybody's looking for, the goals, the metrics, et cetera. But I think as you mature and you go along, you start to your point, you draw back on those early childhood days or early adult, young, you know, whenever you're a young adult, and you say, you know, I think that there's a little bit more to this than just the bottom line. And so over time, I really began to, I think, see a much bigger picture and the entire ecosystem, if you will, and how the people themselves fit into all of this. And that ultimately, at the end of the day, it was all about the people. And so, I think my maturity allowed me to then shift and focus more on the people than so much on results and bottom line.
You've been recognized with two presidential rank awards, two different administrations. You founded your own company. Tell us a little bit more about your background from the beginning and how did that lead you to where you are today?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting, like you said, that I started out as a GS-2, a Social Security Administration. I mean, what I really wanted to be was a criminal prosecuting attorney. That was absolutely my dream. I sometimes joke and say what I really wanted to be was a mafia don, but that wasn't going to work out. So, you know, had to be a criminal prosecuting attorney. But, you know, I had to get a job to pay for college. It wasn't in the cards that I was going to be able to go to college without a job. So I applied at the at the unemployment office. And lo and behold, I got a job at Social Security. I didn't even know it was federal, to be honest. From there, I went to the Department of Defense and I found this career field called labor and employee relations. And honestly, it was as close as I was going to get to being a criminal prosecuting attorney. I didn't go on to be a criminal prosecuting attorney, but I went on courtesy of Department of Defense to get both my bachelor's and my master's in leadership, because the whole study of leadership, I just find incredibly fascinating, you know, from historical to current times. It's just something that's just really fascinated me. And so I would say I'm a lifelong learner of leadership. And then I would say some of the other things that got me maybe where I am today is I never really said no to anything. If people asked me to take on a new challenge, even if I wasn't sure I was going to be successful at it, I would say, you know what, not sure this is going to work out, but more than happy to give it a try. And it always worked out. But I think giving things a try and just not saying no to opportunities is what really led from one position to the next. I feel like I was always rewarded for just stepping in or stepping up and taking on the challenges that sometimes no one else wanted to do.
Angie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Shane. It's such a pleasure. I really appreciate you giving me this opportunity. Thank you.
This has been the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm CEO of WEPA, Shane Canfield. Looking forward to talking to you next time.